Howdy, friends. This is Annie Fonte, and you are listening to the Badass Soul-Seeking Warrior podcast. On each episode, I chat with a different guest and ask them to share their stories about what they were doing before they decided to redesign their life, what they're doing now, and how they navigated through the challenges and events in their life to get to where they are today. What realizations and transformations did they experience? What fears did they overcome? And ultimately, how did they create a life that they love? Good morning, all you badass soul-seeking warriors out there. As you know, we talk about leadership and overcoming challenges in our podcast. And today's guest has enormous amount of experience in both. So I'm happy to introduce you to Serena Sachs Mandel. She has over 35 years of experience in technology and business leadership. She is currently the worldwide, get that one, worldwide chief of technology and transformation at Microsoft in the education industry. And prior to that, she was the chief information officer at two large public school districts where she enabled really individualized education for the students to learn. She's had innovation and transformation teams at IBM, Disney World, Walt Disney World, and Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. So there you have technology, you have the entertainment business, and you have the publishing business. So as I said, she brings a lot of experience from a lot of different industries to us today. And most exciting, I think, today, and we'll talk a lot about it, is she just released her first book. Notice I said first, Serena, more to come, maybe. The book title is Empowered, Frame Your Narrative, Own Your Power. And you launched it last week. So congratulations and welcome. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you so much for including me. And the focus of your podcast is just ideal. I think it was just a perfect fit. So appreciate it.
I agree with that. So let's start with the most important thing first, both for you and our audience. How are you doing today?
I'm okay. I would say every day, even now that I've overcome so much, there are always new challenges. And so I'm actually dealing with some health questions that I'm getting some tests for, but in my head, I'm fine. And so life is good. I appreciate every day and celebrate it.
That's great. So that leads me to start. I want to really start with how you came about deciding you were going to write this book. And this started way back when with you overcoming challenges. So if you'll do us a favor and start at the beginning, because a lot of the things you overcame came about starting in your childhood. So can you give us a little bit of a rundown of how this all played out?
True. So what I actually found out is as an adult, I had this nagging feeling that like, I'm not even supposed to be here. Like, I don't even think I'm supposed to exist. And I did some regression therapy with a practitioner and found out that this came from when I was in utero, that my mother had serious doubts about the pregnancy. And I knew that I was sort of unwanted because my parents told me when I was very young, which is not the healthiest thing to tell a child. And I guess one of the takeaways from the book is that domestic violence and abuse, emotional abuse, can happen in any household. It crosses social, economic, education, every type of line. So my father, both my parents went to Cornell. My father was a veterinarian caring for people's pets and, you know, and the owners. And he was a scratch golfer, a club champion for 13 years. So he's respected. He's very charismatic. So to the outside world, he was an amazing person. And, you know, who knew that he had all these kind of demons that he took out on us, and that he was, you know, misogynistic and just treated me very, very badly. So there were a lot of traumas and challenges growing up. And my parents divorced when I was 5. And then my mother remarried when I was 14. So she was single for 9 years. And then when I'm the youngest, so I moved in with my mother only into my stepfather's house with his kids. And it was like going from, you know, the frying pan into the fire, because, you know, they were horrible to me. And you know, there was a lot of challenges and through formative years through high school, but I did get out. I've been on my own since I was 17. I went to college at 17 and graduate school at 19, and was just driven by just self-sufficiency and knowledge that I was going to have to take care of myself and my goals and my dreams of how I wanted my life to be. And so somewhere, I think while I was in college, you know, I really made the decision that I'm gonna go for this. I am going to build the life that I want and not rely on anybody else. And that's what I've done. I unfortunately was sort of attracted to the wrong person initially, and I had my kids with their father and raised them and realized that maybe it wasn't repeating exactly what my father's situation was, because I was looking for safety and security and stability that I never had, but instead I traded it for kind of control and manipulation and just, you know, not being seen and supported. And so then I went through a divorce, and 5 years later I had cancer, and I spent 2 years fighting the cancer, never stopped working, never stopped my volunteer and nonprofit organization work. And in fact, one time when I left the hospital, I went to the Himalayan Children's Charity and I sponsored a orphan in Nepal. So when I finally finished all the chemo, 11 months later, I was trekking Nepal, I was trekking Mount Everest and visiting with my sponsored daughter in Kathmandu. So that was the beginning of my triumph. So I recovered. It took about a year. And another thing I want to bring out is that, and I talked to a Wall Street Journal reporter about this recently, and they're going to do some research, because I have found a lot of people that have some kind of a cancer or other, you know, life-threatening illness and that recover from, it's often the year after that's worse. So if you have friends or family members or yourself that are suffering now, just remember it doesn't end when the treatment ends.
Right.
And the year after can actually be more devastating. And that's when people think you're fine and they kind of leave you alone, which could be abandonment. Anyway, so I finally felt better. And about a month later, I met my husband, who's the love of my life now. And we are living our dreams. So my story is triumphant. It is like, you know, you have to get your education. You have to set your goals, understand your values, be authentic, and persevere, because every day is not easy. Every job is not easy. But if you define success on your own terms and you frame your narrative as you're the hero of your story, not the victim, let go of those things that don't serve you, like pain and suffering, whoever you think might have caused it, it doesn't matter. Let it go, move through that, and empower yourself. And that's when you can get to the point that I'm at, where my true purpose is really empowering others. And I love doing that. So that's kind of the nutshell of the book. I hope I didn't give it all away.
Okay. Well, there's a lot to unravel there. Let's go back if you don't mind.
Sure.
When you were five, your parents were divorced. But prior to that, do you remember what age you were when they literally told you that you were unwanted?
Six.
So that was after the divorce then.
Yeah. So what happened was we had forced visitation. I really didn't want to see my father because he was abusive, and the judge ordered visitation. And so we would have to go to his house with his new wife. And Sunday nights, he would sit us down in his office, and I can still smell the leather couch and see the whole scene, because he did this every Sunday we visited him. And he would pump us for information about my mother. He would lecture to us. And that's when he said, well, you weren't wanted anyway. We didn't want you. And we would go home crying to our mother. And I asked my mother about that. And she just said, yes, but I loved you as soon as you were born. So she never denied that the pregnancy was unwanted, but it wasn't personal. And I didn't take it personally from my mother. It was just a really hard time. And so she confirmed it at that age.
Wow. I think what you pointed out early on in your conversation here too was what appears to be idyllic on the outside isn't always necessarily true what's going on the inside. I live in a beautiful community, And you drive through the streets and there's beautiful homes and the landscaping is perfect and the cars are always washed and cleaned. And when you see these people out in public, they're always dressed beautifully and whatnot. And it's not always that way when you go behind the curtain. So I think that's something important to keep in mind for all of us, because especially with the onslaught of social media, things look one way on the screen, things look one way on Facebook and Instagram and all the other programs and apps out there. But really behind that, oftentimes people are masking something, that there's a lot of pain, there's a lot of suffering, and there's a lot of trauma that's going on. So it's important to keep that in mind. My so next true. Question though is, going back to your story about your upbringing, is how did you, from the age of 5 till you were 17, so there was 12 years where you kind of had to navigate through some pretty rocky territory. How did you manage that? And how did you get the tools to kind of stay under the radar, whatever you did, in order to leave home and start school, college at 17?
Yeah. So my survival technique, and this is a great message for all of us, it's been hard learned, was to suppress all emotion. I really had no idea about feelings or emotion. My method was functional and effective. Keep moving forward. You just put your head down, don't feel anything, and just keep moving forward. Focused on my education. I ignored the chaos going on in my life. Whatever happened, boom, behind me. And just focused on getting my education moving forward so that I could achieve my goals. And what I learned as an adult, like in my 40s, so a long time after, basically after my marriage dissolved, was that I had never allowed myself to feel much. I was in my 40s, and I guess I had, you know, what you call a midlife crisis or whatever, but I questioned, what is my core? Who am I? Why, like, what is going on? Like, I have a husband, I have kids, I have a wonderful home, I have a good job, but I don't know what's inside me. And I don't know who I really am. I was working 80-hour weeks. I was juggling children, husband, you know, all the craziness of life. And I realized I hadn't smiled in a year. I hadn't laughed. I hadn't been enjoying life at all. I was just working and functioning. And I literally realized that I had never felt loved. I had never felt the right to exist. And this is when I started going through all this therapy and unraveling and understanding what had been going on. Earlier, when I was at about my 30s, I went to a program that I learned this, but I would say it's like an onion. We're always learning more about ourselves. We're always progressing. We're always getting better. Mm-hmm. And so back in my 30s, I did learn that there are lessons that we use when we're children to survive that don't serve us as adults.
Yeah.
I knew that up here. And then 10 years later, I realized what lessons those were, that the lack of emotion and feeling was not allowing me to enjoy my life.
Was there an episode or an event that kind of the light bulb went on and you went, my gosh, here I am in my 40s, early 40s, and I haven't smiled in a year. I'm really numb to feeling any kind of emotions other than keeping my head down and work and give everything to my career and obviously your children, I'm sure. But was there something that kind of turned that light bulb on for you?
I think it was just building up over time. And it just became an awareness, physically, emotionally, mentally. I think it was just building up over time. And then I had the light bulb moment, but I can't tell you exactly what caused it. Maybe just age.
Yeah. That evolution pays off in some way as we climb up the age ladder, right?
Right.
Let's talk about your marriage, your first marriage. Do you feel like there was any aspect of choosing that person? And I'm sure in many ways they're a great person, but that you chose someone similar to your father because that's what you knew and that's what you were comfortable dealing with?
Yeah, that's such a psychological profile that people marry one of their parents.
Yeah.
And I did my darndest not to, because I consciously said, I am not marrying my father. I'm not marrying anybody like my father. So in my mind, my father was unethical. You know, he was abusive. He was there was just so many issues. And my first husband was a lawyer. He was appeared to me to be very ethical at the time and very stable. So my father was highly emotional and would fly off the handle. And so I thought I was going to get stability and security. Now, there were other factors that, it wasn't exactly like my father, but there was really, it's kind of eerie how many things did turn out like my father. And I will say that that he was 12 years older than me. So, do the math. I probably was looking for, somewhat of a father figure. But at some point I outgrew that and I didn't want to be controlled and manipulated and managed. And that was his only MO. Like he couldn't stop. And I also felt like, and I put this in the book because people were like trying to figure out whether, what they should look for in a partner. One of my ahas after I was divorced was I did everything possible to enable and support his hopes and dreams, and he didn't reciprocate. He didn't. I mean, I sacrificed a lot for him, and he did not, like, I did not want to be in Orlando. I was getting job offers in other parts of the country, and he wouldn't allow me to travel, and he didn't want to move. And in hindsight, it would have been better for the family if we lived in a different area. For me professionally, and then therefore for the family. But he, it was sort of insidious because he would make comments like, "Well, yes, I understand. Let's do the math." And we would lose my job. We would lose my income. So take that off the table. He was a lawyer, and he's like, meanwhile, could you have gotten, it wasn't about solving the problem. Like, oh, I could get a job. I could pass the bar in another state. I could, it was always like, well, just take my salary off the table. And it would just, he always make it not make sense. And so it was like, that's really just not going to be good for the family. But in hindsight, it would have been.
Yeah, well, you got to the other side of that. Now I want
Yes.
to go and talk a little bit about you divorce this person, and then 5 years later you get cancer. And I've always been curious when talking to folks who have, whether it's cancer, other, scary diseases, if you will. How
Yeah.
much of that do you feel like was brought on, or at least part of it was brought on because of the dis-ease in your life from childhood
Yeah.
through the time that you discovered you had cancer?
So I think that's a fascinating question. And when I got cancer, I will say this, I had always been super healthy. So I hadn't eaten meat since I was 17. I didn't drink sodas. It just wasn't in my makeup. And I can't have caffeine. So not saying I was completely healthy, but I was pretty healthy. I worked out 4 or 5 times a week. I was hiking and biking and running and lifting weights and doing everything positive. And I was in fantastic shape, way better than I am now, I hate to say. And so when it hit, I was like, are you kidding me? Like me? Look at me. I'm the picture of health. And when you get a terrible diagnosis like that, it's natural for us to say, why? And at the time, the doctors, they are not answering why. They're saying, it doesn't matter. Let's just go fix this. And of course, I've had time since then to say why. And I do think that there is some truth to that, that the trauma that I've lived through, makes us susceptible, let's say. I don't know that it caused it, but I think, but then you have children that have cancer. And you're like, well, they didn't do anything. They don't have trauma, So some of it's unexplainable. I will say, kind of in a humorous way, that somebody that knew my ex-husband very well said, oh, well, you lived with him for 20 years. No wonder. But aside from that, I think your mental health could cause your physical body to be susceptible to various illnesses. So it isn't that we just need to be physically fit, we also need to be mentally fit. And from my perspective, I thought I was. I was practicing law of attraction. I was making sure I have, I'm attracting what I want and, spiritually positive and doing all those things. But even if I was doing that for those, 5 years after the marriage, I think there was just so much trauma for so long. I literally was crying myself tonight just to sleep every night, even through my marriage. So, yes, I don't know that we'll ever know for sure, but it's certainly possible.
And I always say, regardless of what comes to us in our lives, if enough time goes by and we give the dust enough time to settle, there's always a gift in the things that show up in our lives. What have you come to discover the gifts of having been given this diagnosis and now getting to the other side of it?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And when I was first diagnosed, the first 6 months, I was so angry. I was like, I am not going to be better because of this. I am not going to learn. And this is just messing with my life and what I need to do. And then I didn't get better. The cancer returned and metastasized. And the second 6 months, I had a positive attitude. I said, okay, I'm going to beat this. I knew my family, my friends, my colleagues, everybody was fighting for me. And I was resigned at that point to beat it. I was like, that's it. I'm done. We're getting rid of this cancer. And it worked. So I do think attitude is super important. And ironically, the most important lesson that I did learn from it is how to ask for help. So rather than being self-sufficient completely and doing everything myself, it got to the point where I couldn't pick something off the floor. I couldn't function on my own. And friends came and stayed with me. My friends from all over the country came for a week at a time. People at work were like, what can I do to help? And there was one woman who, very, very sweet. And she just kept saying, what can I do? What can I do? And I didn't want to cost anybody any money. I didn't want to say, oh, send me this. So I said, well, you know, I just moved into my house before I got sick. And there's these cardboard boxes in my garage that shouldn't be in cardboard because we know that's not good. And I need to put them in plastic bins. And she was thrilled. She was like, oh my gosh, that's what my daughter does. My daughter and I will come to your house and we will do that. So she came on a Saturday morning and they put all these contents, they labeled them, they put them in my plastic bins. And I was thrilled because I couldn't do that. And they were thrilled because they had been able to help me with something they were good at. And so I just want to say that asking for help is giving the person that does it a gift. They felt so good for being able to help me. And I was grateful because it was little things that I just couldn't do myself. I could work, I could drive, I could go to, you know, here, but little things, asking for help is a gift to the person that gets to give it to you.
Yeah. One of the things I do, Serena, is consult with organizations about their culture. And when you and I talked the other day, you mentioned that you created this cancer calendar for your workmates. So tell our audience about that and how that had any positive effect on the overall culture of the organization you're working with.
Absolutely. So, some people, when they get sick, they keep it very private and they keep it to themselves. I didn't have a partner. You know, I needed a community. I needed to create a work family. And my assistant, who I'm still super close with, she's like, okay, we're going to go to the hospital with you. And all these people wanted to help. So she helped me set up, you know, and they called her and they got on the calendar. But I had people on my team. I had, you know, partners that supported the school district. I was CIO of the school district at that point. I had, you know, peer CIOs from other school districts. I mean, you name it, because I was going to the hospital almost every day for a year. And people were coming and just sitting with me. I got to know them better. Sometimes we kept working. You know, sometimes I was in pain and, you know, they saw me authentically, you know, very, very authentic. People came from all over, friends, family, colleagues, team members, you know, just everything. And that really did bring us all closer. And I did have my book launch last week and it was that family that showed up and they went through it with me and we're all better for it.
I think when we give ourselves permission to be vulnerable, we also open the door for others to show their vulnerability and it's
exactly. Exactly.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the book. The book once again is titled Empowered, Frame Your Narrative, Own Your Power. Why did you write this book?
To inspire and encourage and mentor others. It's the book I wish I had when I was in my 20s or 30s or going through cancer. I saw no role models of people going through what I went through without a partner. When I was young, I was just trying to find my way. You know, woman in tech in New York City for the first 10 years, not easy. I'm trying to give people hope, inspiration, and, you know, share my story to help others. It's all about the reader. And I wanted to just say that the title, my publisher didn't like the title that much, but I have to explain, what is frame your narrative? So when you frame your narrative, like I had this horrible upbringing, but I overcame it. It didn't happen to me. There were people in my life that weren't stable, that didn't do their jobs and be a supportive, safe, secure parent. That's their fault. That's not me. They didn't do it because of me. That's just who they are. So I overcame that. I frame my narrative as I'm the hero of my story, not the victim. And when you do that, then you claim your own power. Because when things go wrong, you're not blaming everyone. You're saying, I have the power to change this. I have the power to show up how I choose. I have the power to define success on my terms. And when you claim that power, it's amazing. You can do whatever you want. So I wrote this book to empower others.
Yeah, you go from being a victim to a victor, you know, and that mindset is diabolically opposed to one another. And I'd much rather be victorious than be a victim my whole life. So good for you.
Yeah, well, people who are victims, first of all, you don't feel good yourself, but you're not really pleasant to be around either, right? So yeah. I want people to be heroes of their story, to be the victors, not the victims. Yeah. So, yeah.
So is this kind of the focus, your audience is 20, 30 year olds, or is this for anybody? As far
I'm
as
finding no matter what the age, people, there's something in there that resonates. Somebody knows somebody who had cancer, somebody, you know, people have been through divorce, people have had, you know, trauma and abuse as a child. So I'm getting great feedback from men, from women, and from all ages and walks of life. But when you're writing a book, and you know this because you've written your book, your publisher, your editor is saying, well, have somebody in mind. And that person that I had in mind, I mentor a lot of people, both men and women, but the people in their 20s, in their 30s, especially, because in your 20s, you're still trying to figure it out. 30s, you might be sort of stuck. Oh, well, I've been doing this for 10 years or so. You know, is this the right thing? Now I have a family. Now, like, there's a lot to juggle when you have a career and a family. And so it's especially for those folks in their maybe 30s and 40s that are balancing career, family, you know, and all the ups and downs of life. So yes, that's the target.
Well, and like you said earlier, you were in your 40s and you were just starting to figure it out.
So. Right. I think I figured some things out every decade.
Right.
It was just 40s were sort of the watershed moment. Like, all right, I need to change everything.
Yeah. All right. So what's your favorite chapter of your book?
Triumph. Everybody likes a happy ending, right?
That's why is because it's a happy, the triumph's all about
happy.
The happy ending.
Or it's the happy ending.
The happy ongoing, because there's not an ending yet.
There's no ending yet. It's ongoing. I would also say that I have three words in there that I chose when I was going through this trauma. I worked with a life coach and I chose my three words. And if I could talk about those for a minute, because I think that's kind of the crux of the story. Contribution was my first word. And everybody can choose their own words, of course. This is just what came to me. Contribution, I was always contributing. I'm helping my siblings, my children, everybody in my life, as well as that's what I do for a living. I'm doing educational technology to contribute to those around me and to the students around the world, right? So contribution, it fills me up. It's not about money. It's about the intrinsic value. So I want that to, it was already happening and I want to continue. The next word, and like I said, when I was going through this, I realized I had no joy in my life. And so I chose the word exhilaration. I wanted moments of wow. I wanted to climb that mountain. I wanted to, you know, bike that 30 miles. I wanted to do things that were in nature and moving and made me feel alive in my whole body, not just my head up. So exhilaration became a pursuit. I want to find more moments of joy. And I almost named the book, you know, Catching Joy, because it's so intrinsic that we have to have moments of joy to feel alive.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third one is aspirational. It's serenity. And it's finding that peace, that calm, that tranquil, that contentment that, first of all, I never thought was possible. And then I thought I would never really want to be like just sitting around and being quiet. But again, age catches up with everybody. And I am looking for that serenity. I am looking for that peace and calm. And that's what we are building in our new house. It's going to be called Serenity.
Good for you. I always say, if it doesn't bring you peace, it's too expensive.
Yeah. Well, and I think of joy that way. Like, yeah. It's, you know, like Marie Kondo, you know, when you're sorting through your stuff, do I feel joy? And it's great to feel that joy. But at the end of the day, I want some tranquility. I want some serenity.
Yeah. And your number one word was contribution. And I'm
yes.
guessing that your contribution to others, which you do a lot of, is it circles back around to be a contribution to you, because it contribution's different than giving all the time and fixing and taking care of others. And I think women especially have a challenge with this, because you've got the kids you're taking care of in the house and the spouse or partner. And if you're working, you have your team at work and all those kinds of things. So you're constantly draining yourself and giving to others. And contribution
right.
sounds and feels like more to me, what you give out in some way, shape, or form comes back to you in a contribution back to yourself. So there's a refill on it.
I think you're right. And I know for me personally, when I see other people succeed, I just helped somebody land their dream job in their dream location. I just attended one of my girlfriend's son's wedding, and you know, the joy that, like, I love supporting and enabling other people's joy and happiness. And that does build me up. It does come back to me. I even find that when I'm not 100%, when I am hurting in some way, it does help to reach out to others.
Mm-hmm.
And when you can help others, then you take your mind off yourself. And right. And you see their joy. So, you know, you have to get outside yourself.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. Now, in addition to these three words, what would you say? And I want people to get this book and read this book. So we don't want to give it all away, right?
Right.
Because I think
right.
there's a lot of nuggets and there's a lot of tools that people can pack into their toolbox as a result of reading this book. But what are the top takeaways from the book that people will walk away and say, that, you know, that was worth the time and the treasure to read those words and implement some of that in my own life?
So we've kind of talked about a few of them, but I'll just go over, without telling the stories around them, the
right.
three top takeaways are: one, to be authentic. And I know everyone says that, but what I'm talking about is to know yourself first. And
yes.
That's not so easy. It's
right.
to know your strengths, your weaknesses, be vulnerable, show up authentically, and create teams that support you and you support them. That's really authenticity. The second one is every day, every job. Not every day is rainbows and butterflies. There's always an opportunity to contribute and make a difference. Always add value, but always learn. Even on a bad day or a bad role, you can learn from it. And you take that with you, and you learn more from the hard times than you do from the easy ones. So suffer through it, persevere, and learn, but always be making a difference. So that's the second one. The third one is live your values. And once again, I don't mean to try it like, you know, just, yeah, sure, I'm living my... No, you have to dig deeper. Like, I love Brené Brown, and leveraging her definition and her work set on value definition is amazing. So you really narrow down what's most important to you, and then do an accounting of your time, your money, and your energy. Do you really live your values? And when you do that and you feel comfortable, you'll know you're in the right place, then you're also living authentically. So it's kind of a circle.
Yeah, I always say, if one can identify their top three values, and my definition of a value is what's most important to you in life. And that can change over time, because we go through seasons.
Absolutely.
And if it changes, great. But to check in once in a while to make sure your values are still what they are. But if we have those in place and we use those as a reference point, it's as if we've created a GPS for ourselves. Because
right.
when we're determining, are we going to enter into a professional relationship or a personal relationship, if we can ask ourselves, in entering into this relationship, will this fulfill and is it aligned with my top three values? If the answer is yes, then that's probably a pretty good decision to make to go ahead and do that. If the answer to even one of those values is no, I sit back and I take a strong look at it. And generally, if it's even one that it doesn't align with, I'll say, I'm gonna take a skip on this, because down the line, this probably won't work out as well as it could if I would have stayed true to my values. So
that's a great perspective. And it's exactly, you know, the same vein of what I'm saying. So yes, align your life with your values, make decisions based on your values, spend your time, energy, and money aligned with your values. So 100% agree.
Okay, so for all those budding potential authors or people that are looking that have written a book, what was that process like for you? Because for me, it was a discipline. I sat down every Thursday all day long and I would work on my book. And it took me about 18 months from the time I sat down and started writing to the time my book came out and I could hold it in my hands and the words were nestled in between the covers. And I was thinking, oh my gosh, all this hard work's finally, there's a tangible thing at this. What was your process like?
So, you know, and I love that process. I wish I could have done that, but I have a more than a full-time job. And I once again took Brené Brown's advice. And she said, because I had been thinking about the book for probably 3 years before I actually wrote it. And when I listened to her on a workshop I was on, she said, just write your SFD. If I'm allowed to say, it's a shitty first draft. just get it all out there. Don't filter it. Don't try to edit while you write. Just get it out there and then edit it. And another friend of mine recently who's written, finishing up his third book, he made the comment, it's easy to write a book. It's hard to edit it.
Yeah.
It's hard to edit. And I was like, oh my gosh, does that ring true? So I will say I wrote my SFD mostly. I've been taking notes for those 3 years. I've been like, you know, taking digital notes all over. I brought those together. I had a chapter outline. I even had descriptions of my chapters. So I brought that all on me to vacation in Belize. And my husband went scuba diving every day. So he was underwater and I was writing. I was sitting, we had a nice place. The balcony was on the ocean. And I just would spend, you know, 10 hours a day writing during that vacation. And then we'd go out to dinner together. So I wrote my SFD and my husband is way more organized. He's an enterprise architect, software developer, all these things. So he took my, you know, stream of conscious, sometimes drunken stuff when it was about the X and all that, because it was just like, you know, all that really emotional stuff. And he interviewed me. He would say, well, how did you feel about that? You're writing like these traumatic things that happened when I was a child. He's like, you're just writing the facts. How did you feel? And I'm like, I don't know. I shut down. And then he was like, you were doing really poorly at some point, and then you turned around. What happened? I'm like, I'm not quite sure. He went in our storage area and he found my diary from my junior year in high school. And he started telling me things I did that year that I didn't remember.
Wow.
But he got to know me through all my writings as a young person. And he, you know, he helped me so much. So he helped me organize it. He helped fill out places that, you know, needed connections, needed more depth. And I went through several other people that were good at editing, really family members for the most part. And then the last week before the publisher was like, you have to get it to me this week. One of my best friends and mentors who is very, very detail oriented and wanted I wanted to make sure I wasn't saying things that were offensive or hurting anybody. And so she went through it. I went and actually lived with her for a week. And my husband wasn't with me until like the Friday night, but I lived with her and I would work all day. And then at night, she and I would go through, she would read it all day and take notes. And then at night we would finalize and she would say, this isn't good. And so we talk about what it should say. And that was the last draft. So I'm sure it's not perfect. I'm sure it could be improved. And I'm looking to collaborate with somebody on the next book because it was a hard process, but cathartic. And ultimately, the point is to help others. And so I'm hoping that it does that, even if it's not perfect.
I'm sure it is. I know my copy's on its way. I can't wait to get my hands on it. And good for you for surrounding yourself with a team. I mean, I should have thought of that. I kind of flailed away all by myself. So I think it's great.
Couldn't. It was too emotional. I could not just go back and edit those. It would be like, you know, I couldn't look at it. It was so hard. So what I could do is talk to somebody who had read it and walk through this sentence and that sentence. So yes, I did surround myself, kind of like when I was sick, I surrounded myself with a community and we got through it together.
Well, and like you say, it sounds like it's not only cathartic, but in a lot of ways, very therapeutic. So you had people that were gentle with you and told you what you needed maybe to hear, but didn't want to hear sometimes, but also kind of kept the framework around getting you through getting this piece of work out into the world so other people could learn from it. What a great crew you pulled together. Okay, I want to switch over now to more the professional side of things. You're 17, you go off to college and you study this very analytical and mathematical degree in both your undergrad and your graduate. And at that time, at least from my experience 35 plus years ago, there weren't very many young girls and women going into this mathematical, high-tech, analytical
right.
area. How did you choose to study that, and what spurred your interest in that kind of a
I always loved technology. I think I was born a little bit too early because I love technology. And the one thing, and I give my father credit where credit's due, he's passed away a long time ago, so he's not looking for the credit, but he gave me, and I have a picture of it in the book, he gave me this Casio calculator, alarm clock, stopwatch. It had all these buttons on it. I took that everywhere I went, and I was just always playing with it. So that was I just love technology. And I'm the one that we got that first microwave. I think you and I are probably around the same age.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, how does this work? I'm like, oh, and I just like figured it out. So I have an affinity for technology, let's say. My degrees in college are actually not computer science. I have a master's in policy analysis and management, which is very quantitative and analytical. So you're right about that. I never took a computer science course. I bought myself one of the first IBM PC dual floppies, taught myself everything. I got every piece of bootleg software on campus without any documentation, no internet to go look anything up. And I learned DOS, I learned Edlin, I learned WordStar, Lotus 1-2-3, DBase, RBase, everything I could learn. And I forced myself to do my homework on the computer so that I would be learning the subject matter. And by the way, I'm getting my undergrad and grad at the same time as an accelerated degree, and I was working. So I had a lot of energy and a lot of drive, let's just say, but I learned it all. And so I got an internship at IBM, and I taught them how to use their computers. I taught the managers at IBM. They didn't know how to use them. They were doing, you know, profs, they were doing 3270 emulation, which is mainframe. They didn't know how to use a PC. So the manager that I was working with at the central headquarters, he said, you should work in the field. You should work. I'll refer you. My wife is a manager there. Go meet with her. And that's how I got a job at IBM in New York City, is through this manager's wife. And I never thought I'd be in sales. To me, sales was like, ugh, you know,
yeah.
Pushing something on somebody. But what I found out is that it was relationship building. Mm-hmm. And that was very scary to me because, like you said, I was analytical, I was quantitative. And my first mentor said, people buy from people they like. And I'm like, yeah. I have to talk to people. I have to ask them how their weekend was and their kids. And, you know, and so that's been, you know, my career life lesson is, it's always about the people. It's always about people. And I am a people person now, but that wasn't natural to me. That, you know, I had this horrible upbringing where, you know, people were scary. If I could just do my job with blinders and didn't have to interact with anybody, you know, that probably would have what I thought I should do. But I'll tell you, I would not trade the sales work for anything. I love working with customers and clients now, and it gives you these skills and these abilities that I would never have had before. So it is not easy being a woman in tech, and I'm on panels all the time. I'm going to be in San Diego, as I said to you, speaking on a panel for women. And that's what we talk about, is what are the challenges. And I'll just say, it's not necessarily easy to be a woman in tech, but we need men. It's not an us or them thing.
Yes.
Men are better mentors and allies for women than women are.
I agree.
So it's not an us or them. We help each other. We make men better. Men make us better. And we need this collaborative chemistry and relationship to be successful.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I gave you what you wanted, but that's
no,
where I went with it.
I love that answer. And I really appreciate you saying that this isn't an us or them thing. This is a we thing, because you're one of, surprisingly so probably, but you're one of the few women I talk to that have that really come, both sides come to the middle outlook on things, because men have so much to offer us and we have so much to offer them. And I think men really appreciate, especially these days, because I think there was a pretty heavy, you know, push against them with the Me Too and whatnot that went on, where they kind of just didn't know how to behave.
How, yeah. Right.
And so
we created a scary environment for men, not we, but you know, in general, the world did.
So they appreciate when a woman comes in and that, you know, isn't trying to be a guy. They're being their feminine selves and they're being authentic and they're including men in the conversation and appreciating their mentorship and vice versa. So I think that that's a really wholesome way to approach, especially if you're in a fairly male dominated, I don't think it's as much as it used to be, but I still think it exists out there. If you're in a fairly male dominated industry or profession, it really helps to the soft approach is much more palatable to everyone than this, you know, if you're a hammer, everything has to be a nail, right?
Yeah. And it's not. I mean, you really have to look at every situation uniquely.
Exactly. So now this to me, because I'm not a tech person either. I'm an artist, and I, like you, I love the buttons. I had my calculators and cash registers. I love that, typewriters, all that stuff. I love that growing up, but not so much the techie side. So this worldwide chief technology and transformation officer at Microsoft for the education industry sounds really, really, really big to me. tell us what you do.
So, and I should have said this at the very beginning, me being here and working and talking about my book is not representing Microsoft. This is me. This is my personal side. So I'm not here as a representative of Microsoft. I'm here as myself. I will just say that my role is global, and it involves working with both higher ed and K-12 everywhere. And it's sales, marketing, engineering. I get feedback to product on how we can make the products more effective or more helpful for in education. I help the educational leaders, whether they're in the technology side or not, the teaching and learning side or the higher ed, in so many different roles. How do they utilize? What can they use technology for to help them achieve their purposes and to solve problems? So it's about leveraging technology for improvement of student outcomes and to improve educator and administrative productivity.
Yeah.
And it's a lot. It's a lot with AI.
Yeah. And one of the things I really appreciated about what you do and the research that I did is this, you really, it was your goal to have an impact in the world.
Right.
Especially when it came to education. And it was to really, instead of this being this rote learning and this very mechanical way of teaching kids, you really had the vision to say, okay, each of these kids are individuals. They all
right.
learn differently. Boys learn differently than girls. And some people like to color and other people like to take pens apart and all sorts of things. So your vision was to create a learning system, regardless of what the child brought to the table, personality wise, and their quirks and their upbringing and all those sorts of things, but to give them tools and resources to learn a way that best suited them. Am I directionally headed down
you,
the road here?
You are speaking for me. So yes, I am super passionate about what we call personalized learning or individualized or student centric. And the idea is that everyone is unique. So if you think about, if you think about healthcare and medicine, we're each unique and we're moving towards personalized medicine as well. And it's the same with education. So the first challenge is to know who the student is, to have this 360 holistic view of the student. You know, what are their strengths? What are their interests? What are their challenges? What are they afraid of? So to know what is going on with the student and then be able to reach them where they are. So during the pandemic, we know that there were challenges, that students have lost reading and math skills. So how do we help them repair that? How do we help accelerate learning? And the fact is that if there's a teacher, there's only one teacher in a room, there's no way they can personalize learning for every student every day,
yeah.
but that's what the students need. There is no average, there is no middle. There's only unique individuals. So that's why I'm so passionate about technology in the classroom, because we can leverage technology to help individualize and personalize the instruction for every student. Like, so for example, and this is all out there in the, you can find it on my LinkedIn profile. I talk about it all the time. Microsoft has learning accelerators, and there's something called Reading Progress. Reading Progress helps students develop fluency for reading. And we know that students need to learn to read by third grade, or they will be affected for the rest of their life. You learn to read, and then you read to learn. And if you don't learn to read by third grade, there's an ongoing challenge. So in order to learn to read, a student should have somebody listen to them and coach them for 20 minutes a day. There's no way a teacher can do that for every student.
Yeah.
And we know, especially in more challenged communities, parents can't always do this. Even, you know, in my life, when I was raising kids and working, you know, 80 hours a week, it was a challenge, right? Reading Progress is like 20 teachers in the room. Every student can read with Reading Progress, get feedback, and then the system reconstitutes more opportunities for the student to read using those words they were challenged with. And it gives real-time data to the teacher so they can see where every student is in the class, what they're struggling with, what they're doing well at. And the students are learning to read so much more quickly.
Now, is there an AI component to this to allow this to happen? Okay.
Yeah.
So a couple more questions, and then I want to swing back to your book and wrap this up with some other questions as it relates to that. I think that I've done a lot of reading and research. I do not have kids, so I'm out of my lane when I talk about any kind of parenting thing. I realize that. However, I do employ young people in my companies, and I've noticed a change in these young people over the time. And a lot of it, I think, has to do with 2008, 2009. I think that's when we all ended up with this thing called a smartphone in our pockets. And
yeah.
Wonder how smart that really was. But
right,
it started to change things. And I think it, you know, having a screen in front of our face, especially for the young ones, is challenging from a brain development. And I don't know this, and I'm not a scientist, but from the reading and the conversations I've had with people who do this, I think there's a lot of positives to online learning and technology. I really do. And I think there's a fine line that we walk by having kids, especially the young ones, but I think any kids from, you know, 0 to 18, probably until mm-hmm. probably mid-20s, really, but having that much exposure to the screen. Now, I think if we took social media and some of that out of it, it would help a lot. But how
right.
do we walk that razor thin line of enough, but not too much?
Right. So I agree with you. And I do want to preface, these are my opinions. These are my perspectives,
right.
having been in educational technology for 15 years now. So we need to use the technology to personalize the learning. But do we want students in their phones all the time and not communicating? Absolutely not. And when the rise of AI, my perspective is that as AI becomes more pervasive in everything we do, our need for human skills goes up even more. So that precious time in classroom with an educator. So once they learn to read, which, you know, we can use technology for, and we can use technology in every grade, but that precious time in the classroom with a person needs to be focused on human interaction, collaboration, presentation, critical thinking, question and answer. Gone are the days when a teacher should stand up and lecture. That's called direct instruction.
Right.
That should be minimized. What we want is the students asking questions, the students giving their perspective. If students are not talking and thinking and creating and doing, they're not learning. They're not engaged.
Right.
And I'm sure this is intuitive to you. Engaged students are learning. Passive students are not. The
yeah.
worst way of teaching is to lecture at somebody. If you're doing something, if you're creating, that's why teachers assign writing assignments, because writing helps your brain process and think and then create. The best way to learn is to teach.
Yes.
So if you get students teaching other students,
Mm-hmm.
they will learn it better.
Yeah.
And the student will get it from another student, which is more on their level in a way they can. So there's just so many ways of creating interaction and developing those human skills, because what you're saying is absolutely right. If you're just communicating with a device all the time, you're not going to learn how to present yourself, how to develop ideas, how to communicate, and how to be an effective adult.
Yeah.
So I really feel, and a friend of mine, I was talking to her yesterday, I want to work with her to support her business and her ideas. Leilani Cawthorn, it's called the Learning Council, Counsel. And she has developed programs. She's incredibly smart and experienced. And she is doing just this work that is disrupting the classroom, giving, think about it. We have an absenteeism crisis and we have a teacher shortage crisis.
Mm-hmm.
What is that telling you? Nobody wants to be in school because it isn't working. And Leilani is disrupting all of this and giving us the future. We had an amazing conversation. She recorded this yesterday on the future of education. And I agree with her. It's got to look a lot different.
I agree. And I love that. See one, do one, teach one.
Yes.
That's kind of what they teach in medical school, I think, to surgeons.
Right.
You watch
right.
it happen, then you do one yourself, and then you teach someone else to do it. And I think a big challenge in our society today, whether it's personal relationships, professional relationships, friendships, the big challenge we all face is that ugly little creature who snuck its way in called disengagement.
Yes.
And
yes.
I think COVID didn't help it at all with that, because it pulled everybody apart from one another. I say it's where it gave us the opportunity to see where we had a lot of dysfunction in our lives, because we had
However,
to face it.
right. However, if you remember the moments after the isolation where you came back and saw people,
yeah.
maybe went out to dinner again, it was like, oh my gosh. And you value the human interaction.
Yeah.
I think we learned that there's a social fabric, that there's an energy when we get together face to face that doesn't exist like this. I mean, this is great. You and I can have this conversation from across the country, and
yeah.
there's huge benefits, and we should absolutely do this. But there's other benefits and positive outcomes from being together face to face. And that's why I'm going to San Diego in a week and a half.
There you go. I love it. So we'll have a few more questions. And
Sure.
this comes back more toward probably what's in the content of your book. But what have been some of your most impactful aha moments in your life?
Well, I feel like I went through some of them with that coach and getting those three words. That mm-hmm. was huge. Pivoting to educational technology was probably the biggest pivot and aha. I started working with Julie Young, who is the founder of Florida Virtual School. And up until then, I'd only been in commercial IT, you know, IBM, Walt Disney World, all kinds of other private sector, large companies, Fortune 100s. And then it's like, oh my gosh, I can use my powers for good. I can use my organizational leadership, my technology ability, and, you know, the fundamental nature of education is what enables every person to be individually successful, but it also influences the whole region. So, you know, you may or may not know that education goes GDP of a region.
Mm-hmm.
This is how Poland has risen. This is how Korea has risen. This is how Finland has risen, through education.
Yeah.
And so I feel like I'm making a fundamental difference in the world by supporting technology and education. And I had that aha when I started working with Julie Young, who's also writing her book. I can't wait for her book to come out. She'll be amazing. That was a big aha for me. I think we'll go with that.
Okay. And speak, because those are wins. Speaking of that,
yeah.
How do you, now that you've gotten past this suppressing of emotions, how do you celebrate your big wins and your small wins? What do you do to bring joy and celebration to yourself about those things?
Yeah. So like when I got the job at Microsoft, my husband and I, we did the happy dance. We just like dance like kids in the kitchen, you know, you just laugh and smile and move around. And so there's moments like that. He and I love, we live on the water and we love to go on our boat and just enjoy, you know, the breeze and the water and just cruising around. So that's a big enjoyment. And then I really look forward to times where I can just spend some solid time with each of my daughters or one at a time. And, you know, as our children get older, I think we really appreciate those precious times that we have together. And I know you don't have your own kids, but you probably have nieces or nephews or other
Oh,
people
sure.
that
You
it's
bet.
just, it's that human connection. And, you know, so that's what we love to do. And even better, we bring them up to the lake house and we all go
That's
out.
great. That's family and friends make a huge difference, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
So, what is one question that you have not asked yourself that if you did, might change your life forever?
For the future or in the past? You're saying in the future? Like
A question you haven't
question.
asked yourself yet, but that if you did, it might change your life forever.
That's a tough one. If I haven't asked already, then I don't know how to come up with that question. You're stumping me. I think that it's something about what could I live without? So maybe because I had so little when I was a child, I'm not as, let's just say I tend to keep things for too long and too much. And,
In the
you know,
plastic bins in the garage.
I still have a lot of plastic bins. And so I do need to start asking myself, what can I live without? I mean, I have things from when I was, you know, 6 years old,
Wow.
and they're sort of nostalgic, but like, really, do I need them? So, I need to ask myself, can, you know, this wood box I made when I was in camp as a, you know, probably 10-year-old, do I really need that? You know, so I really want to get to a point where I purge the extra stuff. So
Well, it's like you
that's.
said, the Marie Kondo question is, does this bring me joy?
But what if it does? All this
Well,
stuff brings me
I think there's we
joy.
have to figure maybe we need to build you a outbuilding where it's your the things that bring Serena joy building, and you that's where you have a place. It's like a little museum.
Yeah, and I have that in like every room in the house. And so I need to say, well, what can I live without?
Yeah.
And let go. I really do need to live without some of these things and maybe just take pictures and move on because you know, stuff clutters up your life and
Yeah,
clutters up your
yes.
mind. And I'm not good at purging.
I will tell you from personal experience, my house burned to the ground
Oh my gosh.
in 2007. Everything, with the exception, I had bins of important papers and things that I always
Yeah.
keep. So if I need to, an emergency, grab those and go. But one of the things I learned, I could live without all of it because I
Oh
did.
my gosh. Wow.
And then when I rebuilt my home and I started bringing things back into it, the question I asked was, do I really want to have this surrounding me? I was very mindful about it. And do I really need this? Or am I just putting stuff in rooms because that's what our society says you need to do? I still have rooms in my home, and it's been 13 years now that I've lived in my new home, that don't have much of anything in them. Because I want it to be special. I want it to have a story around it. And if it doesn't, then I will do without until I find that thing. And maybe I won't ever find something I want to bring back into that space, but it's sacred space now.
It's open space. I think that's so beautiful. I feel like we have a connection because I came up with that and then you just gave me that gift.
There you go.
So that thank you. Thank you
Sacred
for that.
space for
If
sure.
everything burnt down, then
Yeah.
how would you rebuild with just a few things that have a story and have a place?
Yeah. And there were a few things like that, but I would have to say 9/10 of the content that went away could be replaced if I wanted to. The other things, it's just part of the what happens when tragedies like that happen, and you learn from that and you learn to appreciate things more in the future and those kinds of things. But okay.
Wow.
Are there any questions that I didn't know to ask you that would be valuable to our listeners for you to talk about?
So the only thing we didn't talk about that I think is valuable is the culture of excellence that I have built over and over in organizations that I've
Yeah,
been
let's
at.
talk about it.
So it is in the book. And it's a triangle, and the bottom of the triangle is psychological safety. Brené Brown talks about this, Culture Code. There's a book called Culture Code that talks about this. It's well known, but the practice of it is super important, that you create a safe space for everyone to be their authentic self. So I've talked about those takeaways and the authenticity. So that's the foundation of the culture. On the left side is clarity of purpose, of process, of expectations and roles and responsibilities. So that reduces stress. When people know what they need to do and maybe the how of the process and what's expected, and it's very clear, then they can execute very, very well. On the other side of the triangle is shared purpose. Why are we all here together? Why are we doing this? How is this work valuable? So, you know, it's easy when you're doing educational things because you know it's about the student. But I would say, regardless of the work you're doing, there's always a customer at the end somewhere. And that gives you your purpose. Your purpose is always outside of you. It's always about others and doing something good for either others or the world. And so when you have that shared purpose, that clarity of expectations, and that foundation of psychological safety, you can build, you can do anything. That's a world-class, high-performance culture.
You know, and I think this works. Obviously, this is a beautiful triangle of, you know, ways for a corporation to build a culture. But what a great foundation and side pillars to build a family relationship on, a husband and wife relationship on, a parent child relationship on. Those are all, you know, can work. So, you know, your kids need to know that you're safe. Think about your own upbringing. You didn't have
that safe
foundation,
I didn't have
of safety. You didn't have any clarity in what was the heck was going on. You had no idea what you guys, what your shared purpose was, because there wasn't one, right?
It was just chaotic.
It was chaotic, right? So I think that's a beautiful way to end. I think that our conversation added a lot of value to our listeners today. I want to mention again, everyone, you can go on Amazon. I'm sure Barnes and Noble, all the other places that carry books have your book, Serena?
Right now it's just on Amazon.
Okay.
So it's on Amazon and it's under my name, Serena Sachs Mandel. I also have a website, www.serenasachsmandel.com, and I'm also on LinkedIn. So you can communicate with me on my website or on LinkedIn.
I will put all of that information for our listeners' benefit in the show notes for the podcast. So with the links, and you can just go do that. So the book, once again, the title is Empowered, Frame Your Narrative, Own Your Power. Serena, thank you for spending some time with me today. I loved our conversation. I know it will be helpful to a lot of folks out there. And I look forward to staying in touch.
Yes, please. Thank you so much. It was so great talking with you, Annie.
Likewise.
Take
thank
care.
You. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
That's a wrap on this episode of the Badass Soul Seeking Warrior podcast, where we focus on creating a life that we love. And until we meet again, stay true and be you.